The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of
auto, home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you
to discover the difference at
necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system,
improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at
imagine.d-h.org.
Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
We started to walk back, streams of police cars with sirens. Man ran up to us. Are you French? He said. No, I said. Not that way, he said. Seven men, he said. With, he didn't have the word, mimed it. Seven men with guns. Two hands, like holding an assault rifle. We turned around, found one of two bars open, people waiting it out before a big screen of the news. That's this picture, around 1 a.m., I think. We didn't know it then, but we were on one side of the triangle shootings, and our flat was in the middle. We could not walk home.
That is Jeff Charlotte reading from his post on Instagram about the attacks in Paris. He and a colleague were having dinner in Les Halles on Friday, November 13, when coordinated attacks seized the city. Yes, I said writing on Instagram. That is the photo and video sharing social network dominated by celebrity selfies and pictures of pets and brunch. It's also used by more than 75 million users a day. And Jeff, who writes stories in magazine and book form and teaches writing at Dartmouth, has become an evangelist of sorts for the original reporting on Instagram. And he's joining us now from Dartmouth. Jeff, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Hi, Virginia. Good to be with you.
Jeff, I'm so struck at the, you know, the capturing the moment in that scene from Paris. Now, because we're talking about Instagram journalism, there were photographs that accompanied that. What were in the photographs?
The photograph I was just describing is of the two people I was with the night of the Paris attacks, a photographer named Tanya Hollander and a Dartmouth student of mine named Sarah Cotry, who was also in Paris and was closer to the attack, and so we went to retrieve her and ended up getting trapped ourselves in a little bar, and I looked across the table and saw, of course, both of them looking at their phones. Everywhere you walked, you saw, you know, faces glowing blue as people looked at their phones for information, trying to get in touch, and it just sort of struck me as this sort of, this is the image of the, this is the image in some ways of terrorism in our times, is people looking at the little computer in their hands trying to understand what's happening in this world, trying to look in this window. And so I had such a phone, such a little computer in my hand, and took the picture. Just a snapshot, not a framed photograph, just the moment that begins the story.
Not all of our listeners use Instagram, so please, first, what is it and how do people use it?
Instagram, in its most basic sense, is just a portrait or a gallery for you to post snapshots. People post pictures of cats and their coffee and their shoes and selfies and so on. And you make your own gallery, but what happens is you follow other people's galleries. And so you have this constant stream of photographs of your friends' cats and shoes and dinners and so on. Or maybe if you're more adventurous, you start to find this great sort of visual world that's available to you streaming into your phone.
You weren't always a fan of Instagram, so what brought you around?
Cats and shoes and no, I mean, I signed up like so many people to share photos with family, and I think the sort of the light bulb for me was, you know, as a kid I loved comic books, and as a writer I still think about that, the ways in which words and pictures work together. And looking at the way that Instagram presents your gallery, realizing that, oh, here is almost sort of like, the pictures are like panels. Here's a comic book, and I could use this to tell visual stories in a way that I can, because I'm not a drawing artist, that might be able to sort of marry pictures and words like I'd always wanted to. And once I did that, I very quickly started realizing that all the trivia, the cats and the shoes and everything, that was part of this great documentary project too, that those photographs have more intrinsic interest than I'd realized.
So people are documenting themselves, which makes it, as you said, this grand documentary experiment. So What is important about that? Where does it bring us that other places may not?
Well, they're documenting themselves. They're documenting everything. I mean, people who I started following feeds of people who work with heavy equipment, you know, steam shovels and things like that. And they really love their heavy equipment, and they photograph it. Or people who work the night shift. That was really fascinating to me. Hashtag night shift. All the people there working. These are ordinary people being engaged in the documentary art project and journalism and the art project. And in a way that there are barriers of professionalism and everything else that are good. But when you take these things in an aggregate, I think there's this great potential for everyone to be involved in a creative project that is vast and often trivial and sometimes mundane and frequently astonishingly beautiful or revelatory.
You posted several examples of snapshot journalism, as you call it, of with this night shift hashtag of a North Country Dunkin' Donuts. So what inspired this series? What was in there?
Insomnia. It really was. That's sort of how I got into writing. I had a magazine deadline. I write a lot of magazine stories, and I was frustrated by the formulas of it. And up where I live, there's not much open past midnight where you can go to get out of the house and drink a cup of coffee and work. So sitting at a Dunkin' Donuts, and the clerk at the Dunkin' Donuts had this incredible T-shirt with this sort of like gory skull. And I thought, that's an odd uniform for a Dunkin' Donuts guy. So I got to talking to him, and it was his last day of work, and he hated his job, and this was his goodbye to his job. And, you know, I said, can I take a picture of you? In the most obvious way, look at this interesting-looking guy. Can I take a picture with my phone? But I took it and wrote the story, and then people started coming in, and I started talking to them and writing their stories, and realizing that as a journalist who often travels around the world for stories, here was this vehicle that gave me access into the fascinating everyday that was right around me.
I'm speaking with Jeff Charlotte. He writes stories in magazines in book form, and he also teaches writing at Dartmouth. And he has become an advocate and an originator of reporting on Instagram. So you've been doing that in a lot of places. You know, just you've gone to Russia, you've gone to Paris, you've been working in Dublin this semester, just taking pictures of someone, talking to them, and then you have a story. So it is journalism on some level, but what's the distinction here from documenting to journalism?
I don't think in the work that's possible, the work that I'm doing, there's some other writers. Neil Shea is one that I think is really brilliant, who's a National Geographic reporter who is filling his Instagram account with the stories that he can't quite fit into his Instagram work, or a project that he and I have launched with a journal called Virginia Quarterly Review, where we have journalist Meera Subramanian reporting from the sort of the climate change, agriculture crisis in India through pictures and words. It's journalism. The distinction, I think, is one in the way that you encounter it. When you see, I just was writing up a series on Dublin has a terrible heroin problem. And when you encounter these sort of stories of these addicts and their lives and heroin and so on, and then the next picture down is your cat picture or whatever, you see these things as not separate from the world, not exoticized, but as a part of the world. And the other thing that's really interesting for journalists is thinking visually. Neil Shea, my collaborator in this Virginia Quarterly Review project, and the hashtag he came up with was called Killing the Nut Graph. And for non-journalists, the nut graph is the who, what, where, when, why mm-hmm. at the top of the story. And it always frustrates a lot of journalists because you have to sort of step on your story with this sort of dull explaining. Well, and here, the photograph is the nut graph. The photograph is the who, what, where, when, why. It's this image, and it allows you to step right into the story with an immediacy that is often not possible in a magazine story. So I don't really see the distinction. Now, if you talk about Instagram as a whole, obviously I see that as a documentary project. Most of that's not journalism. But the potential for journalism is really great.
Jeff Charlotte, thank you very much, and best of luck on your continued project.
Thank you, Virginia.
Jeff Charlotte, he's author of the New York Times bestseller, The Family, among other books. He teaches writing at Dartmouth and posts on Instagram at Jeff Charlotte, and that's JeffSharlett. You can find a link to see his Instagram journalism and the stories that he mentioned in a partnership with the Virginia Quarterly Review. All those links at wordofmouthradio.org. We live in the age of the internet famous, the YouTube channel hosts with millions of followers, the Vine and Instagram stars who parlay viral moments into steady cash flows. But for every multi-million dollar web sensation, there are countless artists stuck in a sort of fame purgatory. As Gabby Dunn puts it, too visible to have real jobs, but too broke not to. And Gabby would know. She's one half of Just Between Us. That's a YouTube comedy channel starring herself and her friend Allison Raskin. They have 500,000 subscribers and put out 2 videos a week. But that does not mean they're on easy street. Gabby wrote the article, The Sad Economics of Being Famous on the Internet, for Fusion. And Gabby, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much, Virginia.
So if you don't mind me being so forward, how do you make money from your show?
That's okay that you're forward. I think that's something that more YouTubers and more people who make content on the internet need to talk about, how they're making money and who's paying what. We make money through YouTube, through AdSense, but the ads that play before videos, and also branded deals where companies will sponsor one video. But I think people have this idea that you're making so much money just through YouTube or just from the videos, and that's not the case. A lot of times the videos are what lead to other gigs, so freelance writing or acting gigs, or, you know, working with brands on their channels to make stuff for them that will never appear on our channel. So there's this idea that YouTube itself is giving content creators tons of money, and you can just work on YouTube and that's it. But that's not the case. It leads to paying gigs.
Yeah, that was kind of my impression, that, you know, if someone was internet famous, they were making some bank. That's not your story.
No, I mean, you can have a ton of Instagram followers, but until you monetize that in the sense of like posting a video of you holding a box of autumn goodies that this company wants you to hold, then you're not going to make money just by posting to your, you know, 340K fans on Instagram. You have to turn that into something. But it's also this double-edged sword because fans hate that.
That was something really interesting in this article, like how people, you know, bite back at the quote-unquote sellout. But first I want to go to, you told so many stories in this article of people who, very much like you, exist in this kind of middle ground between fame and financial success. So tell us some of those stories.
Sure. The beginning of the article starts with a friend of mine, Brittany Ashley, who works for BuzzFeed, which is a huge company, and now she's there full time. But before she was there full time, she was an actress on their channel, getting paid $100, $200 for one-off videos. And she appeared in a lot of videos for them. And BuzzFeed has 17 million subscribers, so she was one of the most well-known faces there. But since she wasn't hired full-time and she was just getting paid for one-off videos, she needed also to have a full-time job. So she worked at a restaurant, and she would get recognized often at brunch and stuff. Often the kids would be very confused as to why this person that they watch on their computer and see as famous is working at a restaurant. BuzzFeed Golden Globes party was at her restaurant, so she was working serving the people that she also acted opposite.
So she was waiting tables at the restaurant where they were having this celebratory party. People thought she was faking.
Yeah, they thought she was doing a comedy bit. But she was like, no, I work here.
She's got enough fame currency to be recognized, but not enough real currency, I guess, to pay her rent.
Yeah, yeah. And then she eventually, I mean, this is her story, but she eventually like put her foot down to BuzzFeed, and now she works there full time. But the other situation is like this girl, Rachel Whitehurst, who was working at a Starbucks in Seattle, and she was making videos, and she had fans memorize her schedule at Starbucks and show up all the time to bother her at work. And so she eventually had to quit working there.
What do you think, Gabby, that's any different for social media stars than maybe actors who may make a living doing, or half a living doing, commercials, or musicians who aren't quite famous enough to stop waiting table? I mean, this middle ground success, is this a product of the internet age, do you think?
I think it is, because it's more, it causes things to be more widespread. You can have a huge number of fans all over the world who don't have to come to the performance. The performance is you posting it on the internet. They don't have to come to the cafe to see you. I mean, often people don't look up the actors in things. Like, I have friends who are on HBO shows who have less subscribers to their YouTube or less Twitter followers than I do, because I think the fans see me on their computer and then follow me naturally to other things on their computer. Mm-hmm. But if you like an actor in a show, you're not necessarily going to like their Twitter as well.
That's interesting. So if you see someone on a show, I mean, you don't have the same kind of access or, I think, sense of intimacy. How do you think that plays into it?
Oh, completely. There's an actress that Allison and I love, and we love her performance on this show. We think she's wonderful. And then we both had to stop following her on Instagram because she would just post about Jesus all the time. And we were like, it's not the same. Like, we're not following the character from the show that we love. Whereas on YouTube, it is intimate because you're playing, quote unquote, yourself.
You and Allison did a sketch for your show, and it's called Don't Read the Comments. And, of course, the whole idea is that you're trying to film an episode of your YouTube show, but you keep stopping because you're both obsessed with all the critical feedback people have given you. So let's hear just a clip from that.
Action.
Gabby, I can't believe this.
Cut. Allison, why are you talking like that?
Oh, some people say that my voice is too high-pitched, so I wanted to make it more relatable and less grating.
I have some notes on the script, actually.
You wrote the script. We're halfway through the script.
Yeah, but I was going through my Tumblr mentions, and people seem to find the Gabby character too aggressive, so I want to try to be a little less divisive. Mm.
But that's your whole thing. You're divisive and the sexually aggressive one.
Oh, can you see this? The label?
Just spin it.
I don't want people to think that we're secretly trying to sell them Trader Joe's water.
One, two, check, check.
Ow, could you not do that?
Sorry, people get really upset when the audio quality is bad.
Mm-hmm. Number one complaint.
That's Allison Ruskin and my guest Gabby Dunn from Just Between Us, their YouTube show. Well, Gabby, you talk in your article about stars have to be careful about being perceived as sellouts, something that you sort of knock on right there in that little clip. How does that happen?
People seem to get very upset when you start monetizing your following. But I think it's because they think of it as greedy and they don't realize that it's getting paid to do a job that you've been doing for free. We'll get comments like, stop with the promotion, stop with the sponsorships. But Allison and I have been making two videos a week for free for 2 years. So there's, 110 unsponsored videos that you could watch that are free. And we've made maybe 5 sponsored videos.
So do any of your followers, your many followers, pay for the videos? Do they support you financially?
Some of them do, yeah. There's a website called Patreon that is wonderful. I mean, the content is free. We would make the content for free. They're not paying to see anything, but they're paying as sort of like a one-person sponsorship. So Patreon's been a really good way for creators to make money because the fans will support them directly. However, in the article, I mentioned that a lot of times there's a push to support small YouTubers, which is like people with 10K followers or people with 5 or 20K followers. But Allison and I have over 500,000. So people didn't realize that this is a channel that they would need to support. There's no metric for what a big YouTuber is and what a small YouTuber is. It used to be you hit 1 million and you're golden. But now people have 7 million, 12 million. Like 1 million doesn't mean as much as it used to.
It's so interesting, though, that you're to have the support of your fans, you have to appear poor, for lack of a better word. I mean, you can't be making money on this, but yet you can't continue to do it without any money.
Yeah, and we also, our channel is a sketch comedy channel, and we post very often, way more often than a lot of channels do. So we have more overhead than, let's say, a person posting a vlog once a week would. We bit ourselves in the butt about that because we just wanted to do high quality, like, scripted content, and that takes money. So we pay our crew and we buy clothes and costumes and stuff like that. And that's, we could just, I don't know that the channel would be as successful if it was just us in front of a camera talking into like a shoddy camera. But even those people, they have to buy better lights, buy better sound equipment. Like, each type of person making stuff on the internet has their own overhead. Beauty vloggers, they have to go to Sephora and try to find the latest thing to keep up in the competition of, we can't review something that came out 4 months ago. So there's costs to all of it that I think fans don't see.
So what would be success in your eyes? Is it purely financial benchmark, or do you have other goals in mind?
Well, a lot of YouTubers want to just be YouTubers. And it's very interesting because, young fans will say, I want to be a YouTuber when I grow up. And that's not really what you mean. Like, Allison and I want to write a television show. We want to make a sitcom based on us. And so that was sort of always the goal of the channel. And Allison and I used to work for BuzzFeed. And we would get young people saying to us, I want to work at BuzzFeed. My dream is to work at BuzzFeed. And I would always say, no, your dream is to work in video production. Your dream is to produce television or films. Like, you can't think of it as this company is the end game or making YouTube videos is the end game. These young people have to know that what they actually want is to write content, to be video producers. Like, it's this disconnect that I don't think that they realize.
Well, Gabby Dunn, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Gabby Dunn, she's a comedian and a writer, and she's internet famous for her YouTube channel. It's called Just Between Us. You'll find a link to read her article, The Sad Economics of Internet Fame, which she wrote for Fusion. That's at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. As presidential candidates and their staff travel from state to state, shaking hands and kissing babies, a different kind of candidate is recovering from a similar cross-country adventure. But instead of riding a campaign bus, he rides a horse. And he's not really campaigning for anything in particular. Producer Jen Nathan brings us his story.
It's a chilly gray morning in Hendersonville, North Carolina. 40 people and half a dozen horses stand shivering in an asphalt parking lot. This is a rare place to meet a celebrity.
I'm just thrilled to be here. Really excited.
I didn't know if we'd get a parking spot.
But this is a historic moment.
It is.
It's not Barack Obama or even Brad Pitt they're waiting to meet. It's a man named Bill Inman.
It started off with a small idea and then kind of grew and grew. You just don't wake up one morning and go, oh, I just think I'll just take a horse and go across the United States.
But that's exactly what Bill did. 7 months ago, he left his home in Lebanon, Oregon, and headed east on his horse, Blackie. Today, he's getting Blackie ready for the last 12 miles of the 2,900-mile trip.
I'm putting his bridle on. It's kind of like your steering wheel. We've got saddles, and he's all ready to go. You know, I know there's a crowd waiting for us over there, and they're going to have fried chicken, and people want to be a part of the deal. We're having a big dinner down there at Schroeder's Honda, since it's a big parking lot.
Like a candidate on the campaign trail or someone on a PR tour, Bill has more than one stop to make today. He's invited anyone with a road-ready horse to meet him 4 miles up the road from the Honda dealership to ride beside him for the last leg of the trip. But so far, more people than horses have shown up, and they're starting to get restless.
I'm anxious to see this horse.
How long have you been here waiting?
Oh, about an hour now. Wait, this is long. I got to see this horse.
I don't know many people have done it. Do you? So I think maybe one day he'll be famous, I hope. So that's why we're down here, to see it.
Would you like to do something like that someday, right across the country?
Yeah, because I'd get noticed more, and I'd get famous, and have a lot more people know me.
Have you met Bill yet?
No, ma'am.
Are you excited to?
Yes, ma'am.
The crowd, which has grown to nearly 60 people, has heard a lot about Bill.
Oh, I've been following the newspaper.
Saw it on the news when I first started.
Read it in the newspaper.
More than 20 newspapers, including the Associated Press, have followed Bill's seven-month journey. His wife, whose initial job was to drive ahead in the horse trailer and set up camp, has become a makeshift PR person. Nearly every mile of the trip has been documented by independent filmmaker Dallas Pizzola. And Bill's son, Jonathan Campos, came along to post videos to Bill's website. Yes, the man riding his horse across the country has a website. Maybe this is the true embodiment of the American dream, to bask in the cult of celebrity in every small town across America.
Would you have done this trip if people hadn't paid attention, if it was just you on your horse alone?
The journey wasn't to be just me and the horse. It was all about something that people would come see. You know, what we want to do is profile, you know, some of the people that never get recognized, like Hall of Fame cowboys and, you know, Hall of Famers or elderly people.
Bill's been given free dinners, met mayors, and even received gifts from little old ladies by the side of the road.
A lady said, hey, Bill, here's a little cross, and hopefully it'll bring some sunshine, some good luck. So So I put the cross in my pocket, and I always never had more than $5 in my pocket. And all of a sudden, I got 20s. And now look, see, I still got 40, and I still got the cross.
Bill has plenty of tall tales like this one, and he says people from all over the world have read about them on his website.
The simplest things, like my wife cooking cowboy cornbread. We filmed it. 200 people were cooking cowboy cornbread in India. I get emails from China. I get emails from Iraq.
But the trip hasn't been all cornbread, emails, and photo shoots. Bill and Blackie have hit some rough patches along the way.
We had problems with the weather. We had problems with topography, altitude, about everything.
Including loneliness.
You don't have anybody to talk to. And you're like, you know, I've been doing this for 4 days and I haven't even seen a house.
But Bill didn't give up. He likens a journey like this to swimming halfway across a river.
Well, what are you going to do? Turn around and swim back? Might as well just go ahead. It's just as far going forward as it is going back. Just point him east and ride another 20 miles and see what that changes.
Maybe this is why people have been so fascinated with his story. Most Americans show up at work, sit at their desks, and do pretty much the same thing day after day. But Bill's taken a big risk, and for the most part, it's paid off.
It is the toughest thing I've ever done in my life. The most rewarding thing I've ever done in my life.
And this is the most famous Bill has ever been in his life. As a ranch hand, an Army helicopter pilot, or the owner of a range management business, Bill hasn't gotten a lot of media attention before this. He hasn't been fazed by it during his trip, but he admits he hasn't always liked sharing the fame either.
Yeah, he's a special horse. I think he's more well-known than I am, because I've had people pull over and go, "Is that horse named Blackie?" They don't say, "Is your name Bill?" You know what I mean? We have national reporters asking, "How does Blackie like his name spelled with an I-E or a Y?" It'll probably happen today.
I just want to see Blackie. I want to see him take off on the last part of his ride.
Off in the distance, a man in a cowboy hat and a dusty trench coat slowly becomes larger. The crowd moves to the edge of the parking lot, watching as Bill passes by a gas station and a Chinese buffet, until finally...
Hey! Hello, sir.
Thank you. Great honor.
Ma'am.
After shaking hands, giving autographs, and even posing with a baby, Bill rounds up the 13 horseback riders here to join him for the last 4 miles of the trip. Across town, a different crowd is gathered at a new parking lot, ready to greet Bill at his final destination. Family and friends gather round long tables, piled high with fried chicken and homemade German chocolate cake. With his horse, his wife, and his filmmaker by his side, Bill is happy to share today's limelight.
Everybody, this is my mom.
In Hendersonville, North Carolina, I'm Jen Nathan.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. With New Year's just around the corner, millions will resolve to exercise more in 2016. And while the first few weeks of January mark a noticeable uptick in gym memberships, statistically, less than 10% of weight loss resolutions will last. Damon Young is an honorary fellow in philosophy at the University of Melbourne, and we spoke to him when his book, How to Think About Exercise, was first released. It's not going to offer you tips for getting perfect abs or teaching you how to run a 5-minute mile, but may just help your resolutions stick. A philosophy book about exercise may seem like a bit of an oxymoron, so I asked Damon if that was the point.
Yes, in part. In fact, I wrote the book partly because people were so surprised that I, as a philosopher, would exercise, that I'd be, you know, swinging kettlebells or indoor rock climbing or, punching on with a friend in the backyard doing karate. And I realized that there was some strange divide in people's minds, that they thought that if you were an intellectual person, a bookish person, a curious person, then for some reason you wouldn't be interested in sport or exercise or fitness, that is that you were kind of disembodied. And I wanted to explore that a little further because I got the feeling that it was exiling some people from the commonwealth of the body.
Well, talk to me more about that divide, this kind of dualism of mind and body. How does that manifest?
Well, it's often the idea that, for example, someone who is a sports person must be an idiot. So there is a wonderful caricature played by Brad Pitt in Burn After Reading, the Coen brothers film. He's just the beautiful stereotypical jock, just kind of positive thinking mantras and oiled muscles, but he's thick as, he's as dense as a bag of stones. And this trope, this kind of metaphor permeates our culture, and it's basically the idea that there are two realms in the world. There's a realm of mind, of the soul, of spirit, of thought, and then there's a realm of bodies, flesh, carnality. And you get the sense that some people think of their bodies just as kind of machines that need to be tinkered with. So you go to the gym, you do your reps. It adds nothing to your intellectual life, your emotional life at all. It's just about kind of tuning up that body. And what happens is it's dull. It's boring. It adds nothing to their life. They leave. What I'm suggesting in the book is that there are all kinds of enhancements to the intellect and enrichments to character and the imagination that you can get through your body. So you have to kind of bring your mind and your body together mindfully.
Let's hear just a clip from that Coen brothers film. Chad is the name of the character you're describing, a sort of gum-smacking personal trainer. Let's hear it.
The quality of the intelligence dictates how high up he is, okay. Not what we know. I also... Do you have any water? I gotta hydrate.
I got tap water.
Are you kidding?
How do you know who he is?
Sources.
What do you mean, sources?
You got like Gatorade or anything besides like Maryland swamp water? Do you know how far this is from my...
How do you know his name?
So you're talking about integrating the thinking person and the athletic, the workout person, you know, the kind of philosopher athlete, which sounds to me kind of Greek. Is there a philosophical basis in this?
Yes, there is. What I do in the book is I go back to the Greeks, back to Socrates, for example. He was, of course, the teacher of Plato. Plato was the teacher of Aristotle. So these are the beginnings. And interestingly, in the dialogues of one historian and general, Xenophon, we find Socrates talking about the intellectual importance of the body. And there's another theme in the Greeks too, which I talk about, and it comes out in the Iliad. There's a running race in the Iliad where Odysseus beats Ajax. Mm-hmm. He basically wins by cheating. A god comes down and helps. But to the Greeks who are watching, it doesn't matter because it's an awesome thing to see people strive and compete and win. And what I'm suggesting is that we've often lost a sense that pride through your body is a good thing. There's nothing wrong with taking pleasure in yourself. Now, that might be the pleasure of running up a hill. It might be the pleasure of rock climbing. It might be the sublime sense of swimming. But you don't have to get some kind of personal best to do this. You don't have to beat someone else. And you don't have to get an Olympian's body.
Hmm. But let's go a little further with the pride, which can sometimes cross over into a kind of narcissism. At one point in the book, you advise people to look at themselves in the mirror naked and experiment with different poses. Okay, that could be self-torture for some of us, or it could be a kind of, I don't know, narcissism, couldn't it?
Yeah, that's right. First of all, what I'm doing with that mirror is to get used to the way our self-esteem, our sense of our own beauty or glory is often dependent on our ideas of others. So that if you look at yourself naked and imagine someone who is an Olympic athlete, you're going to feel bad about yourself. And then if you imagine someone who is less fit than you, who might be softer than you, you might feel better about yourself. It's showing the arbitrariness of a lot of these feelings. But the second thing is when it comes to narcissism, yes, this is a very real danger. And there are some correlations with some power sports and weightlifting. But I'm suggesting that an interest in the way you look is not a bad thing, as long as you recognize that it's just the way you look. So I talk about the thrill that we get as humans from looking at new unities, harmonies, and forms in our bodies. It really is a thrill to watch new muscle groups coming out, the relationships, the proportions in our bodies. The problem is when we think that these muscular groups say anything else about us. They don't make us a better person. They don't make us more deserving of respect or sexual glory. They are simply a muscular development.
Pride is one of the virtues of exercise, with benefits that aren't always directly related to health. But one of the virtues you write about is a harder sell, and that is pain. You know, for those of us who do not have a god to come down and help us, isn't that why so many of us avoid working out, this fear of pain?
There's a scene in Roadhouse where Patrick Swayze is being sewn up without anesthetic.
I just can't believe you're quoting Roadhouse now.
And Swayze turns to this doctor and says, "Pain don't hurt." Now, it sounds glib and a little bit ludicrous, but in fact, he's right. There is evidence to show that the way we think about pain and the meaning of the situation changes how we feel that pain. Getting crunched in the abdomen when I'm doing martial arts and getting crunched when I trip over my son's Lego and fall on a couch, both of which have happened, mm-hmm. Feel the same. It's the same impact on my body. In the case of tripping over and hitting my side, I'm furious, I'm angry, I'm ranting, you need to clean up your Lego. When it comes to martial arts, it's all just part of the fight. In fact, there's something bracing and invigorating about that very same strike. I'm not angry at my friend for punching me. I'm not saying that exercise won't hurt. It will hurt. What I'm suggesting is that when it's part of a meaningful activity that we are committed to, pain is less of a problem, and we may, in fact, welcome that pain as a sign that we are striving.
Because you are talking about integrating mind and body, yeah? And a lot of people, when they're working out, they try to keep themselves distracted. You know, they watch television maybe in the gym, or they listen to music with their earbuds in. You're not such a fan of that. Why?
I don't mind it at the gym. I think gyms can be quite sterile places. So if you're on a treadmill or you're on a stationary bike, you know, it might be fantastic to listen to a podcast or some stimulating music. But what I'm suggesting in the book, partly inspired by Charles Darwin, is that when you go for a walk or a run, you might want to actually engage your senses and allow the reverie that arises when you walk and run to be engaged with the stimulating world at a human pace. Because a lot of the time we're speeding around our neighborhoods or around the city behind glass, you know, at 55 miles an hour. We're not engaging with our world. Stop, take the time, see what's around you. You'd be surprised what you find.
We're talking with Damon Young. He's a philosopher and author of How to Think About Exercise. It's a new volume from the smartest self-help series / most accessible philosophy series I've yet come across, The School of Life. Damon, who's this book for, though? I can imagine the soft intellectuals and armchair philosophers, because it doesn't really seem like the kind of thing you'd find in the stack of, you know, Shape magazine or Men's Health magazines at Gold's Gym.
Okay, I think there are a few audiences for this. The first are people who have defined themselves against the body, against fitness, against exercise, because they see these things as kind of annexed by jocks, by thugs. And so they're alienated from the fitness industry and often from their own bodies. Then there's another group of people who do go to the gym, who are interesting, curious, you know, bookish people. They have a rich intellectual life. But when they go to the gym, they switch their minds off. Now, for some people, this is fantastic. They've used their brain all day. They don't want to do it anymore. But there are a lot of people who give up at the gym, partly out of the banality of it all. Mm-hmm. These are people who want mental stimulation. They crave good conversation. They're interested in rich ideas and impressions. But when they go to the gym, that all stops. So what I'm suggesting is they need to remind themselves that there is the sublime in swimming. There is aesthetic richness in doing weights. There is pride in sprinting and reverie in running and so on. Then I think there's one last group, and these are the people who are outstanding athletes who are looking to broaden their intellectual life. These are the Chads from Burn After Reading of the World, who everyone's just said, man, you are so buff, you are swole, man. But what about their ideas about art or music or ethics? So these people need to be given the chance to enrich their minds.
So for all of those people who profess to want to exercise but complain that they just don't have the time, maybe they are making intellectual pursuits. Do you think that's a legitimate argument?
It's certainly true that it is difficult to find the time, you know, if you work, particularly if you have children or you're studying. The first thing is to realize that physical striving is no less important than having a job. You are a body. You live through your body. Why not engage it thoughtfully? But secondly, you don't have to go to the gym. I know that if I had to go to the gym to work out, I would not work out. This is partly because gyms are expensive, but it's also because I know I'd have to stop what I'm doing, get in the car, drive to some place, change my uniform, engage in banter with people I may not like, and so on. I'm revealing a little bit more about my personality here. A lot of my exercises are solitary. You'll pick that up in the book. So a lot of the exercise I do is from home. I run around my own neighborhood. I do chin-ups and push-ups in my own home. I have kettlebells in the garage. So what I've done is I've integrated exercise into my daily routines. So it doesn't have to be something special. It's just something I do. Another way is to see obstacles as opportunities. Now, I know that sounds like a horrible self-help tagline. You've not failed. You've just missed a chance for greatness. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm suggesting is, take the stairs in buildings and railways. It may be exhausting at first, but you'll feel awesome afterwards. If you're taking public transport, stop a couple of stops before when you get off. And then walk the rest of the way.
Well, Damon, if we reround the clock, you know, just I guess a week or so ago, is there an exercise resolution that you would suggest to replace the more generic, I'm going to go to the gym 3 times a week, or, you know, I want to lose 15 pounds? What would be a better resolution?
My resolution would be exercise as a whole person rather than just a mechanical body. So if you want to see yourself enjoying exercise for the whole of your life rather than for the next 6 months, try to imagine those things that will keep you stimulated over the decades, not just the weeks. So that's not just going to be your personal best or sort of rock hard Olympian abs, because you're probably not going to get those. And it's fine to be realistic about that. Instead, what is going to stimulate your imagination? What is going to sharpen your intellect? What is going to give you a sense of pride? These are the things that keep people motivated over the years, not necessarily whether they can get a movie star body.
Damon Young, he's an honorary fellow in philosophy at the University of Melbourne and author of How to Think About Exercise. It's a book from the School of Life series, and you'll find more in the book at wordofmouthradio.org. We're so glad you could join us today. Remember, there's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And don't forget, you can listen to the show anytime with the Word of Mouth podcast. You'll find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And do us a favor. If you like the podcast, rate it on iTunes. It'll help others find it, and it's another way of sharing by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.